high levels of lead force some state workers out of their offices. Good evening, I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about the slow opening weekend of big game hunting season. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with a marine ecologist about what we can learn from the adaptable octopus. Nearly 100 employees of the Montana Department of Environmental Quality are staying home on paid leave for the next couple days. This after inspections found elevated lead levels in one of the department's own buildings. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the building used to contain an indoor firing range used by the Montana National Guard.
It's not a snow day, sending employees home from the Department of Environmental Quality's building on North Last Chance Gulch in Helena, although there is plenty of it swirling around as all workers exit the building by noon. The state says levels of lead found in dust above the ceiling tiles are more than 40 times what the federal government recommends for residential housing units. The findings were part of more than a year-long examination of the building, which is Helena's old armory.
I need to stress that we are using an abundance of caution.
DEQ Director Tracy Stone Manning.
And we are now asking additional questions. Is that lead in the air that the employees have been breathing? Is that lead in our employees' bodies?
The building's 98 employees will be on leave through Wednesday, while the State Department of Administration finds temporary workspace. State officials are suggesting the employees all get their blood tested, which will be offered to them for free. DEQ has been in the old armory since 2002, and most of the workers there are part of the division responsible for environmental cleanup. Again, Director Tracy Stone Manning.
The irony is not lost on us.
It's a little ironic on how it was discovered.
That's Superfund site project manager Dave Bowers. He's been working in the building since the department first moved in more than a decade ago. He says from the beginning, some workers were complaining of respiratory problems or skin irritation. Now, a lot of DEQ workers have annual blood work done because they're out in the field working around environmental contaminants. And unusual findings were coming back in some of that blood work, even though some workers had not been out in the field for a while.
Well, we're going, but I haven't been out to my site. I haven't been doing this.
So the department started looking more into the building's history.
Being scientists and inquisitive people, we started researching and going, you know what? They have a lot of problems with indoor firing ranges.
The Armory building was built in 1942 for the Montana National Guard, and until 1994, it contained an indoor firing range. The Department of Administration says some lead remediation efforts took place then when the range was closed down. But Dave Bowers has been part of the team working on the examination of the building since August of last year. He believes the type of lead found above the ceiling tiles comes from bullet primer caps. He says he does worry about his health and the health of his coworkers.
I think that goes without saying. When you find out that you're working in an area or a place or living in a place where there might be something impacting you or your family, you're going to naturally be concerned.
Bowers says DEQ will now be moving into more intensive screening of the armory. Air samples were conducted this past weekend, and lead level findings from those tests should be available later this week. The department will also be testing for other contaminants like mold, fiberglass, and asbestos. It's unclear how long the building will be closed, but officials predict a few weeks to a few months. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, attorneys for Montana State University are asking a federal judge to dismiss a lawsuit filed by a former student who claimed a music professor raped her. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports the school argued today the woman's lawsuit raises the same claims she made in human rights complaints that she settled for more than $234,000 last year. MSU's attorney Andy Forsyth of Billings said by accepting the offers of judgment from the school and former professor Shuichi Komiyama, she agreed the amount of judgment was sufficient to remedy her complaints. The woman's October 11th lawsuit seeks damages for negligent hiring, retention, and supervision of Komiyama, along with assault, battery, and infliction of emotional harm. The woman claims both Title IX and civil rights violations.
A man has died in a single vehicle rollover on U.S. Highway 83, about 10 miles north of Condon. The Montana Highway Patrol tells the Missoulian the crash was reported at about 8:30 this morning, but it is not clear when the crash happened. Patrol Captain Steve Lavin says there was an elk in the back of the crashed pickup. The victim's name, age, and hometown haven't been released.
A 32-year-old whitefish man was shot and killed last week during a confrontation with law enforcement officers in Northern California. Police in Weed, California, say the confrontation began when Steve Hughes Henning set a fire on a wood porch at a bus stop Thursday. Officers say Henning refused to put out the fire and violently resisted arrest despite being shocked with a stun gun. Police said the altercation continued with an officer using pepper spray on Henning during a violent struggle after he jumped into a patrol car. Henning fled with the officer's stun gun. Officers found Henning later that night and say he again violently resisted arrest and tried to injure a police dog. Both a Weed police officer and Siskiyou County deputy shot Henning. He died at the scene.
Officials in Missoula County have released the name of a 41-year-old Missoula man who died in a weekend motorcycle crash west of Lolo. The Missoula County Sheriff's Office tells the Missoulian that Christopher Tucker was traveling westbound on U.S. Highway 12 on Saturday afternoon when he lost control on a bridge. The Montana Highway Patrol says Tucker's motorcycle crossed the center line and sideswiped a car. Tucker died at the scene.
A lot of hunters went home empty-handed this weekend in west central Montana. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks reports 2,424 people went through check stations in Region 2. Regional Wildlife Manager Mike Thompson says that's almost the same number as opening day last year, but this year's opening weekend harvest declined.
Well, for example, last year in the three stations, one at Bonner, Darby, and Anaconda, combined for opening weekend, we had 118 last year elk harvested. This year, 98, and that's lower than any time in the last 5 years that I have in front of me. And mule deer for all three stations. We don't get very many mule deer on opening weekend typically, and we got 35 last year and only 18 this year. And for whitetail deer, 67 last year compared to 55 this year. So enough to call it a difference.
Thompson says the weather was most likely to blame for this year's slow start.
I think that the big thing was that it was just too darn nice a weekend. There's not much of an advantage for hunters without tracking snow and some kind of weather to start moving animals around a little bit. And as I look outside the window now, I think that weather is coming in it. Unless it gets to be a big blizzard, we won't move lots of elk, but some animals will be moving. There'll be some tracking snow, and I know a lot of hunters out at the Darby check station were looking forward to the change in weather to get out there and give it another try.
He says elk populations, generally speaking, are quite high right now.
But the range in there locally that makes up that total number is extreme. We've lost an elk herd in the last few years in Burdett Creek out at the upper end of Fish Creek, virtually lost that elk population. And on the other end of the scale, we've got elk numbers in the eastern part of our region higher than we've ever recorded before. So it depends where you're standing, whether it's a time of feast or a time of famine.
Mule deer populations have, again, generally speaking, declined across much of western North America. Thompson says whitetail populations are showing signs of rebounding. This despite a fatal outbreak of a virus spread by biting gnats that recently killed some 400 deer in the Missoula area.
Whitetail deer were low in the last couple of years, but we have good indications that they're coming back strong now. And so we're looking forward to a little better harvest and a little better recruitment with our whitetail populations. The HD was localized in the valley just west of Missoula, and there were spots where we collected samples and got confirmation scattered elsewhere across the region, but it was quite spotty. So I don't think at a big scale that we're talking about a lot of change in our whitetail populations.
This week's weather forecast is calling for partly to mostly cloudy skies, scattered showers, and warming temperatures by the weekend.
Former State Representative Jennifer Gursky says she resigned from the legislature to take a job in Helena. The Missoula Democrat said today she has moved to Helena and started a new job as development director for the Helena Food Share. Gursky says she resigned her seat on October 22nd because legislators need to live in the communities they represent. She was elected to the position in 2012. Montana law requires a person of the same political party to be appointed to serve the remainder of Gursky's term, which expires in 2014. The county's central committee has 45 days to nominate three people to fill the position, and county commissioners have another 15 days to notify the Secretary of State of their choice.
A black bear was struck and killed on the interstate on the east edge of Butte, and authorities believe it was the same bear that had been hanging around a Butte neighborhood early last week. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Warden Sergeant Coy Klein told the Montana Standard the bear was struck Friday at the interchange between Interstates 90 and 15. An adult black bear was spotted in a Butte neighborhood last Tuesday. Wildlife officials initially left it alone, figuring it would leave. When it did not, game wardens made an unsuccessful effort to trap it. Klein tells the Montana Standard they're pretty sure the same bear was killed on the road Friday. He says it was the same color and size.
The octopus is a very adaptable creature. It can shrink itself to fit into a discarded beer bottle for temporary shelter, can change color, and squirt a cloud of ink to camouflage its escape from danger. Dr. Rafe Sagarin thinks humans have a lot to learn from the adaptability of the octopus and from nature in general. Sagarin is an associate scientist and marine ecologist with the Institute of the Environment and Biosphere 2 at the University of Arizona. He's also the author of two recent books, Learning from the Octopus and Observation and Ecology, Broadening the Scope of Science to Understand a Complex World. Sagarin is in Missoula to give a talk in the President's Lecture Series at the University of Montana. In this feature interview, he talks with News Director Sally Mock about his belief that we can apply lessons from nature to address problems like global terrorism, infectious diseases, and natural disasters.
Really, anywhere where we face uncertainty in our lives and risk in our lives, and it doesn't have to be terrorism, it could be the next business cycle, or it could be the risk of starting a new classroom for the semester. That's an area where we can learn from how nature has dealt with uncertainty and risk for 3.5 billion years.
And nature has dealt with this by being immensely adaptable.
Exactly. Right? It's all about how adaptable you are. The very first thing is both in being adaptable and learning how to be adaptable is to observe the world, really to look at the natural world in a whole new light. Really as a source of wisdom for us, but then look at how do all these natural organisms, without any ability to plan or make predictions of the future, become so adaptable to whatever comes around.
And the octopus, of course, is a prime example of this.
Yeah, the octopus is my favorite example of it because the octopus, surprisingly to a lot of people, is not unlike us in the sense that it has a really smart, intelligent brain, but it doesn't necessarily let its brain get in the way of its ability to adapt quickly if it needs to adapt almost instantaneously. It has ways of doing that. So it nicely balances its kind of central controller, its mind, its brain, with this very quick ability to adapt and change.
You've also written, though, that we should not expect perfection or that we can completely eliminate risk. And certainly that's what we see in nature as well. I mean, there are some who don't survive.
Yeah, that is true. But the really important lesson from nature, if you look at the whole sweep of life, which has spread over the earth and done so many remarkable things, is every one of those life forms doesn't have any sense of trying to be perfect. I sometimes hear on television about the great white shark being nature's perfect predator, and I always laugh and say, well, you know, it would be a lot better if it had laser beam eyes to stun its prey. There's really no way to even measure perfection in nature, and we tend to focus too much on trying to find perfect solutions to things.
Nature winning the global war on terrorism.
Exactly. Right? Trying to win a war on terrorism or a war on drugs. In my own field of ecology, we have a war on invasive species. These are just general risks that are out there, and we have to learn to live with them. I say that a fish doesn't try to turn a shark into a vegetarian. It learns that it has to deal with predation in its world, and it learns that by becoming adaptable.
I can't help noting, Dr. Sagarin, that your call to observe nature comes at a time when humans are ever more distanced from the natural world.
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing where, unfortunately, both as adults and more in our children, we're distancing ourselves from that just daily practice of going out, looking at nature, seeing complex systems. You cannot replicate the complexity of nature in a binary, computerized, screen-based system. No matter how good your resolution is on your latest generation iPhone or Android, you're not going to see the complexity that you see just by walking around in nature. And by doing that, by being out there and living in this complexity, we learn to become observers of patterns in a complex world. And that is the very first step that any organism or any organization has to do to become adaptable. Now, I will say this, that technology is giving us an advantage in being able to see and connect more and more observations around the world so that we can get a lot of information about our changing world by activating a lot of people around the world to look at change, or people that are closest to the change. And it's a lot of what we talk about in adaptability is decentralizing the way that you respond to a change or a problem. And this is exactly what the octopus does when it camouflages itself, has all its different skin cells, each individually responding. This is what our immune system does. All our immune systems are running, cells are running around looking for invaders and responding to them without really any conference calls to our brain.
But certainly part of your message is that we need to close that distance that we have with nature as much as we can, or we're not going to get that education.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, nature is the biggest source, the biggest database, if you will, on information about how to be adaptable. There's nothing even close. You can look at all the business case studies in the world, and they wouldn't make up a tiny fraction of all the case studies that nature has on how to be adaptable. So the more we distance ourselves from that, the more it's to our detriment, because we're losing that really rich source of information.
You've also written that, quote, "We are losing our ability to connect, empathize, and understand the complexity of other people."
Yeah, and I think that is also a function of separating ourselves. And what I really think we need to look at is, again, not I never think about kind of total or perfect solutions, getting rid of all our screens and going back to nature and that kind of thing, because there's been a lot of benefit, of course, from all this technology. And the idea is, how can you merge these incredible new technologies we have with this more organic and deeply evolved sense we have of connecting to nature? And I think there are lots of ways to do that. We're talking about different programs you can do with kids that both let them use this technology, but also get them out into nature. So there are really great websites out there like Project NOAA, where kids, like my daughter loves going there. She'll go out on a hike, maybe photograph a snake that she's never seen before, put it up on the website, and within minutes, someone from around the world, a herpetologist, is saying, oh, that's a rare tiger rattlesnake or something. And so it connects her to all kinds of expertise, but it also keeps her wanting to go out into nature and seeing things.
What can we learn from nature, if anything, about communication? Because that seems to be a huge, huge issue for us. Certainly the federal government shutdown would be one prime example of a poor communication.
Yeah, there is so much to learn, because nature is constantly communicating in all kinds of ways at every level, at the cellular level, at the individual level, between individuals, and really interestingly, between individuals that you would think wouldn't want to communicate, like prey and predators, are constantly communicating to one another. Prey species are constantly looking out for predators and then actually talking to predators when they see them. And that sets up an exchange and says, you know what, I see you're there. Don't waste your time and energy trying to eat me. And it's usually a good enough signal that the predator will go somewhere else. But what's really interesting is that a lot of species, prey species, learn how to communicate to their predators in the predator's language. So there's this great example of a ground squirrel that will scream to a hawk or a coyote. to say, I know you're there, but it won't scream to a snake because snakes don't hear. And it'll actually puff up its tail in kind of this menacing way. But if the snake is a rattlesnake, and only if it's a rattlesnake, it also heats up its tail because rattlesnakes see in infrared. So you're talking about a prey species that has learned to speak the language of its enemies. And we really do a poor job of this. We really don't take the time to understand the language of our adversaries and try to communicate in that way to them. And just one really blatant example is after we killed Osama bin Laden, we released videotapes that supposedly showed how pathetic this guy was in his house. And all the newspapers in the West picked it up and said, you know, images of Osama show how frail and vain and, you know, basically what a loser he was. We're trying to not let this guy become a martyr. Well, the Muslim world, especially the radical Muslim world, saw these videos and it reinforced every heroic image they had of this guy. Because where we saw this pathetic, disheveled loser, they saw a man who kept his beard even though he was supposed to be in disguise, a man who lived in humble circumstances even though he was rich. He was bobbing up and down in this way that we thought of kind of freakish, and they saw as a devotional prayer kind of movement. So every signal we sent reinforced this idea of him as a martyr rather than the message we wanted to send, because we didn't send it in their language. We sent it in our language.
It's a fascinating field, and I have been speaking with Dr. Rafe Sagarin, who is an associate scientist and marine ecologist at the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona and part of the Biosphere 2 there as well. Dr. Sagarin, thank you so much. Really fascinating conversation, fascinating research.
Yeah, it's been great to be up here in Montana. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Dr. Rafe Sagarin will give a free public lecture titled Learning from the Octopus, How Observations of Nature are Transforming Science and Society, tonight at 8 o'clock in the Denison Theater on the University of Montana campus.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there is a wind chill advisory in effect from 6 p.m. this evening to 6 a.m. tomorrow for the Missoula Bitterroot Valleys, the Butte Blackfoot region, and Potomac Sealy Lake region. Tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with areas of snow and lows 9 to 16 degrees. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies and highs in the 30s. For central Montana, there's a winter storm warning in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front and Maher counties. That winter storm warning is also in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for elevations above 4,500 feet for Cascade, Shodo, Central, Southern, and Lewis and Clark County, Judith Basin, and Fergus counties. There's a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for Eastern Glacier, Hill, Toole, Liberty, Eastern Pendere, Blaine, and Eastern Teton counties. That winter weather advisory is also in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for elevations below 4,500 feet for Cascade, Shodo, Central and Southern Lewis and Clark, Judith Basin, and Fergus counties. Tonight, snow is likely with lows 10 to 15 degrees and wind gusts up to 45 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy in the morning, becoming partly cloudy with slight chance of snow through the day and highs 30 to 35 degrees. Southwest Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for elevations below 5,500 feet for Beaverhead, Madison, and Gallatin counties. There's also a winter storm warning in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for elevations above 5,500 feet for Beaverhead, Madison, and Gallatin counties. Winter storm warning in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for elevations above 4,500 feet for Jefferson and Broadwater counties, and a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for elevations below 4,500 feet for those same counties. Tonight, snow is likely with lows 15 to 20 degrees and wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow through the day and highs 30 to 40 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Stan Bradshaw.
I work for Trout Unlimited as a water rights lawyer, mostly working with irrigators to lease some part of their water rights to improve stream flows. A lot of my work happens in the Blackfoot Basin, a watershed that, for at least the past two decades, has had an active conservation and restoration effort. The Big Blackfoot chapter of Trout Unlimited got the ball rolling in the early 90s when it set out to restore a severely debased trout fishery. That effort eventually helped pave the way for the creation of the Blackfoot Challenge, one of the most successful watershed-wide conservation efforts in the state, if not in the nation. Over the past two decades, between Big Blackfoot TU, the Blackfoot Challenge, and a host of other organizations and individuals, hundreds of people have been engaged in a community-based approach to dealing with resource issues ranging from drought response to stream habitat restoration to endangered species management to weeds, to name just a few. The underlying philosophy has been to protect and restore the valley's natural resources while maintaining a working landscape. As with any human endeavor, it's not perfect. Not everyone likes all of his neighbors, and like any small community, the Blackfoot sees its share of petty jealousies, long-running feuds, and assorted other dysfunctions. And some issues just don't lend themselves to cooperative problem-solving. But while the format doesn't and should not rule out full-scale adversarial fights on some issues, it does provide a forum for diverse interests to work cooperatively, face-to-face, on resource issues of common concern without first manning the barricades and pitching bricks at each other. On balance, the cooperative approach has been pretty successful. A quick check of websites of either the Challenge or the Big Blackfoot TU will lead you to a litany of accomplishments each organization proudly proclaims. And they should be proud, as much for the manner in which they've accomplished this as for the results themselves. The effort embraces the concept of community. Implicit in that concept is that they're all in it together, so they work hard at being respectful and constructive, even when they may encounter profound disagreement. In an age where overheated rhetoric and scorching invective all too often seem to be the predominant means of communication, this watershed community approach offers a hopeful alternative. What may be most important about the Blackfoot experience is not just its specific local accomplishments, but rather that it is part of a much larger movement to watershed-based cooperative conservation efforts. The Blackfoot experience is being replicated in larger and smaller ways all over the state. There's even a watershed umbrella group, the Montana Watershed Coordination Council. And because watershed groups focus closely on ground-level problem-solving, always a time-intensive undertaking, new hands are always welcome. As any watershed coordinator will tell you, for all the good energy of watershed group participants, there's always more work to do than hands to do it. Whether it's working on a particular resource committee, helping out with the riparian vegetation project, or just showing up for a weed pull. So if you're looking for an opportunity to get engaged in conservation in a way that will have lasting rewards for both you and your community, consider getting involved with a watershed group. If you're not sure how to get started, Google Montana Watershed Coordination Council and check its directory of watershed groups. It lists something on the order of 60 groups. Chances are you'll find a group working in an area near and dear to your heart, and chances are that they'll need some help on something somewhere, and the chances are that if you get involved with a watershed group, you'll be glad you did. This is Stan Bradshaw sitting in for Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited.
Stan Bradshaw is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.